with the research that's being done, the MAPS and other organizations are sponsoring, and just with the broader cultural shifting that we're seeing here about our attitudes towards drugs, that there's going to be more acceptance and more research into these drugs in the future.
Now, for our listeners who may not know MDMA, that is kind of this the street name for that is ecstasy. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. And this is exactly one of the ways that it's challenging to communicate about this research, because we have to differentiate between the pure compound, which is MDMA, methylene dioxymethamphetamine, which is used in research, and the compound, which is usually tainted and adulterated when it's distributed on the illegal black market. In fact, ecstasy and what's now become known as Molly on the street, we've heard a lot of coverage about that lately too, often, in fact, usually don't contain any MDMA at all.
That's really horrifying.
It really is. It really is. So one of the key dangers of taking illegal drugs, because they're illegal and because they're unregulated and because we don't know what's in them,
because you know a guy who knew the guy who knew that other guy. Right.
And that's in the black market a substitute for regulation and accountability.
Right.
Yeah.
Just to kind of go back in history to kind of get our listeners up to date, after a trial in 1963 found LSD combined with counseling reduced anxiety, depression, and pain in advanced stage cancer patients. It was followed by studies with more than 100 advanced stage cancer patients, this is 1963, that established the approach and demonstrated safety and promising results. The psychedelic method was most commonly used in patients with terminal cancer. These studies were difficult to design as placebo-controlled studies for ethical reasons and difficult to successfully blind because of the psychoactive intervention. On March 4th, 2014, the results of the first study of the therapeutic use of lysergic acid diethylamide, did I say that right? LSD, in humans in over 40 years were published online in the peer-reviewed Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, sponsored by the nonprofit Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, MAPS, that's you, the double-blind placebo-controlled pilot study in 12 subjects with advanced stage illness found statistically significant reductions in anxiety following two LSD-assisted psychotherapy sessions. That's what we want to know more about.
Great. Well, this study that just came out, that just this week on Tuesday, March 4th, was published in the Journal of Nervous and Mental Disease, was, in fact, the first study completed looking at the therapeutic use of LSD in humans since the 1960s. A lot of those early studies were not placebo-controlled. It is, as you mentioned, difficult to deal with the issue of the placebo in clinical research about psychedelics because it's fairly obvious, usually, both to the subject and to the therapist, whether a placebo has been taken or not.
And I just want to say that happens on the street as well.
Yeah, exactly. You know, we did find, some benefits of the therapy, both in our MDMA research and in our new LSD study, without the drug. But what was most exciting is that in combination with the drug, we found 20% reduction in symptoms of anxiety in people who were suffering from advanced stage illness, in people who had received the LSD in combination with psychotherapy.
And so you have people with advanced, or can we say incurable?
Yeah. The requirement for enrollment in the study was being diagnosed with an advanced stage illness such as cancer or leukemia. In fact, many of the subjects who participated in the study did not live more than a year following the study. But we do have one subject who has spoken with the press and has talked about his experience really found that the combination of LSD and the safe setting of psychotherapy helped him see beyond the anxiety that he'd been experiencing as a result of his disease.
I think that most people know that it is illegal to manufacture LSD in the United States. Is that correct?
Well, that's almost correct. It's illegal to manufacture LSD without a license.
All right. People want to know right now. They're like, how can I get a license?
Yeah, well, it's kind of complicated, but let me tell you how you do it. You find a research team. You find a body of evidence suggesting that a Schedule I drug has a potential therapeutic value for a particular condition. You develop a protocol. That means you write out how the study is going to be conducted, and then you submit that study to the Food and Drug Administration.
Now, that seems like, what do they call it? That's like a catch-22 or an endless loop or a Mobius strip, because how do you gather a body of evidence for an illegal drug to present it for a study?
Well, fortunately, the body of evidence for using LSD combined with psychotherapy already existed. We already had some early writings from the 1950s through the 1970s from psychiatrists and therapists and researchers who were administering LSD to thousands of people. So we were able to use that evidence and say, hey, you know, look, people have already found success in these anecdotal situations, you know, not in clinical trials. We have seen some success, and here are the stories. So if you look at the study protocol, which is available on the MAPS.org website, you can see the references that we use, and we refer to some of these older published studies. So that's how we generate the rationale to propose a study like that to the FDA. And when it comes to psychedelics, there's such a long human history of the use of these drugs. It's really only in the last century that we've criminalized any of them. LSD has been around since the 1940s. MDMA was synthesized in 1912. And then some of the naturally occurring psychedelics, which we're also exploring in research contexts, such as psilocybin, ayahuasca, ibogaine, those have been around for many thousands of years and have a long history of human use for spiritual purposes and for therapeutic use. So we can actually point to that research as a justification for proposing these studies to regulators now. And then in addition, there's also a wide body of online evidence. There's sites like Arrowhead.org and other forums and places where the internet is now enabling people to share their experiences. And there's a lot of people who are finding benefit in whatever way they can articulate it and posting those online. So there's more and more ways to recognize the positive effects that these substances are having for people, and then to use those experiences as justifications for legal clinical research.
In the clinical trials that are going on all over the world, what are some of the distinctions that you encounter between regulations in the United States and regulations in other countries?
There actually is a wide difference in how regulators see psychedelic research in different countries. And what that highlights is that what we're struggling against is not politically, it's not primarily a political obstacle, because legally research is technically allowed, even into scheduled compounds all around the world. The issue comes when you propose a study to a regulator who themselves have been miseducated and misinformed about the drugs and have developed a fear to them. And so previously, prior to the late 1990s, 1992 was the first legally approved research into a psychedelic in humans. That was research into dimethyltryptamine, or DMT. But it wasn't until the early 2000s that research really started to move forward and to be approved by regulators. And what that means is that it's a cultural blockade that we're facing, is that people have suspicions, even regulators have suspicions of what these compounds are because of their history of association with recreational and irresponsible use, and therefore they have in the past been resistant to passing our protocols. And that varies very differently country to country. Our completed study looking at LSD-assisted psychotherapy that was just published this week, that was conducted in Switzerland. We gained permission from the Swiss regulatory authority there, SwissMedic, to conduct that study, and it was reasonably easy. That primarily being because in Switzerland has always had, or for a long time has had, a very open and scientifically exploratory attitude towards drugs, including psychedelics.
Well, we're just going to call it progressive.
Yeah. A progressive attitude towards psychedelics and psychedelic research. I think that's a great way to put it. We also tried to start a study looking at MDMA combined with psychotherapy to treat post-traumatic stress disorder to complement our ongoing international research program in Jordan. Unfortunately, Jordanian regulatory officials at the Jordanian FDA were not ready to approve psychedelic research in Jordan and rejected our application to conduct the research without any explanation. That's also different from what we found in Canada. We have a study looking at MDMA and post-traumatic stress disorder in Vancouver that is just now getting off the ground. And that study took us about 5 years to start because of a series of security requirements that Health Canada kept throwing at us as we tried to get permission to store the MDMA for the study.
And so when you have permission to do a study, wherever it might be, in the U.S., in Canada, in Switzerland, and I'm not trying to learn this so that I can pursue acquisition, but, you know, how then do you go about, you know, acquiring the drugs?
Well, you know, if we get approval to store and administer one of these Schedule I drugs, what it means is that the Drug Enforcement Administration, here in the U.S. at least, the DEA is not worried about you being able to get it, because they've reviewed the pharmacy, they've reviewed how we're storing the drug, they've reviewed how we're using and encapsulating the drug in every way, and really every molecule of it is, literally every molecule of it is accounted for.
Do you have a licensed, approved laboratory?
We do. That's what took us so long in Canada, was getting the license to store the MDMA in the Vancouver pharmacy for the study. Health Canada kept coming back at us for years saying, no, the pharmacy isn't secure enough to store this compound. So we had to install thicker glass and reinforce the windows and bolt the safe to the floor and a bunch of other very, very expensive security upgrades because Health Canada was concerned that several grams of MDMA would be stolen from this Vancouver pharmacy, which contains unknown amounts of prescription opiates and painkillers.
Right, much more desirable.
Which are much more desirable.
Right. Yeah. They were not under lock and key in the same manner.
Well, certainly not. So that it reflects how regulators see these drugs, or they see the political risk of these drugs, is that this tiny amount of MDMA, which somebody could purchase on the street relatively easily, you know, they require us to jump through hoops for 4 years in order to store it in a legal pharmacy.
What a conundrum. Here you have, at least in the U.S., a rainbow of anti-anxiety and antidepressant or personality-altering medications that are advertised to you really every day, multiple times a day, at least through the television. And they affect, you know, the chemicals in your brain. They change your perceptions. They may make you hallucinate. I mean, they have a host of side effects that you should call your doctor about. And yet, they don't have the same stigma as these psychedelic substances. And I just it's all the 60s, right?
I think a lot of it is.
Is Tim Leary right? It's his fault.
Tim Leary is a complex figure. And I just heard an interview with Timothy Leary. He was actually on a radio program in, I think, 1965, maybe?
No doubt.
He was speaking with this radio host, and Tim, you know, he was trying very hard to explain to people that LSD does not make you crazy. It's about how you use it. And he was trying to explain how it could be used scientifically and how important it was to him and his perspectives. But he lacked the language to talk about it. He fell back into religious terminology and claiming that it was the best thing ever. And then he said it was the most difficult thing ever. And just trying to impress upon the radio host how important he thought LSD was. But Tim was living in an environment then where the host would constantly assault him and would use every opportunity to undermine him and constantly disrespect him, even though he was a PhD Harvard professor.
Right.
He would be so condescended to. And so I see that in that context, if somebody had just discovered a compound, and especially a compound as powerful and, yes, dangerous, but also useful drug as LSD, put in that position of constantly being under assault from the media and also from politicians. It wasn't just the media. It was people with real concrete political concerns who were targeting him. That, you know, I can imagine that under those conditions, one could get very defensive and withdrawn and possibly crazy. So, you know, I can kind of see in our historical progress that we've been making here is that it's a much more open environment now because we're far enough from the 60s. And, you know, like you suggested, we're also getting so suspicious of the drugs that do exist and the treatments that do exist, and we're looking for something better.
And a lot of people who, I mean, really more than a lot of people, I mean, all the baby boomers who maybe at least once tried psychedelic substances are aging and getting to those end-of-life issues. Their friends are dying. You know, we're getting older and starting to really see, you know, that your mortality isn't nearly as far away as it was in the 60s.
Right. I think that's a key thing, too, is we have a generation that's aging a lot and starting to think a little bit more about the end of their life and starting to think a little bit more about some of the more intense and exciting and memorable experiences that they've had. And for millions of people in the United States alone, that might have been LSD. And for all these years, they've lacked the public forums and the confidence and the trust in the people around them to talk about their experiences.
Right, for fear of also being stigmatized. Now, tell us about the patients in the trials.
Well, all of these patients, it enrolled 12 subjects, all of whom were diagnosed with advanced stage illness, and all of whom were also diagnosed with anxiety associated with that illness. 12 subjects is a very small number of subjects. So it's important to point that out when we're talking about this new research, is that this is early clinical research. And while thousands of people have received LSD in the context of psychotherapy, those were not clinical trials. So in order to really make LSD into part of a legal prescription treatment, we need to conduct these clinical trials, which means more studies with more subjects. So in these 12 subjects who were diagnosed with anxiety, being at the end of their lives, they were also evaluated for other conditions that could make the administration of LSD more risky or more difficult. Fortunately, the risks of LSD are very low. It has minimal effects on heart rate and blood pressure and other aspects. So that's one reason that LSD...
I want to interject and say sure. Real LSD doesn't do that.
That's right. Real LSD doesn't do that. And, of course, the LSD that we're using here in this clinical trial is in a pill form. It's not on paper. It doesn't have dancing pink elephants on it. It's clinically, pharmaceutically manufactured LSD.
Is it the LSD-25?
Yeah, it's LSD.
Of our youth?
Mm-hmm. Well, presumably of...
Presumably of our youth.
Yeah,
that's right.
Exactly.
And so these patients that were administered, it was in a clinical setting. It wasn't, like you said, it wasn't at home and it wasn't at a festival.
That's right.
It was in a clinical setting with clinicians present at all times, from what I've read about the studies. And so can you talk about, you know, some of the outcomes that they experienced in terms of, you know, their trip?
Yes. Yeah, you definitely can put it that way. You know, LSD, it's interesting, and I really love having this conversation about the anti-anxiety effects of LSD, because people say LSD, but doesn't that cause anxiety? Doesn't that make you distressed? Isn't that a scary, or can't it be a scary experience? And the answer is yes. it certainly can. And in fact, that's what we found in this study, is that during this therapy session, subjects were enrolled in two LSD-assisted psychotherapy sessions that were spaced 2 to 3 weeks apart, depending on the subject. So the results that we're talking about are the results of just two instances of receiving LSD in combination with psychotherapy. These subjects, 11 out of 12 of which, by the way, had never taken LSD before. They came in for their first session, followed 2 to 3 weeks later by their second session, and many of them reported having a very difficult experience, a very anxiety-provoking experience. But the presence of the psychotherapist, who's a psychiatrist, his name is Peter Gasser, he's a private practice psychiatrist living in Switzerland, actually made people feel more comfortable in the long run, because what they reported afterwards was that these expansive and even at times difficult experiences they were having in the context of psychotherapy, after they were done with the therapy, they had a different perspective on their illness and a different perspective on how they related to their own death. So we actually saw significant reductions at about 20% of a certain measure of anxiety after these two LSD-assisted psychotherapy sessions.
How do you measure 20% of anxiety?
There's a score. It's a questionnaire called the State Trait Anxiety Inventory, which is a standardized form that is used all across clinical research into anxiety and anxiety treatments, and is one of the standards used. So it can be compared with other treatments. So we can look at other pharmacological or therapeutic treatments that also look at this particular questionnaire and compare it with those other ones.
Is 20% worth it? Is that, like you said, it's a really small trial, really, really small. And also, you know, obviously doing placebos with psychedelics is probably not really that effective, because you really know if you got the placebo.
Yes.
Like, you're not going to be like, I wonder if I got the placebo, or I wonder if I got the LSD. You're going to know conclusively. But the patients who had 20% reduction, what does that mean? I mean, how does that translate into the human, you know, experience? Does that mean that they were able to kind of wrap their head around their deaths, and the deaths that they know are kind of coming?
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to put it. LSD can produce feelings, and subjects reported having feelings of expansiveness or interconnectedness or unity with the sort of broader world around them.
Cosmos.
And that experience of kind of not having a personal boundary, and the experience of being ultimately connected with the universe, as a lot of people described it, gave them a different perspective. So these 20% reductions in anxiety that we're seeing, which were also maintained a year later, we followed these subjects for a year, and they still had these reductions in anxiety, are definitely positive trends. So even though we have a very small number of subjects, just 12, we did see these statistically significant reductions. And then in addition, the other exciting part about the study is we found no negative effects. There was no evidence of future addiction. Nobody was craving LSD. Nobody had a severe negative reaction, and nobody got worse. So not only in this very small preliminary study did we show that we have some significant benefits that can come from using LSD in psychotherapy, but also that it can be safely administered. And so that just opens up the field in a way that it hasn't been open in four decades.
You're listening to The Digital Divide on KBOO Portland. Today we're listening to an interview with Brad Burge, Communications Director at MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. That's right. And we're talking about the research that is being legally conducted throughout the world, including the United States, with MDMA and LSD. And I'll have an update for you at the end of the show. We have news, the marijuana research that they have struggled for decades to secure federal approval for has been granted. So we'll have a little news and update for you. And now let's move on with the interview. Now, I know that you're a marketing and communications director and not a clinical scientist.
Right.
But what can you share with us? I know that experience with LSD of having that kind of unification, identification with I'm making air quotes, the universe, and being connected to all other beings. That's a very common experience, whether you have terminal illness or not, if you've taken LSD. What is it about LSD that makes that happen in our brains?
That is a great question, and it has not yet been answered.
Is that right?
That is right. We do know how LSD is directly acting on the brain. LSD is a molecule that is very, very similar to another molecule that occurs in the human body called serotonin.
Right. And after you take LSD, you don't have any more of that for about 24 hours.
Well, that's actually more MDMA. LSD actually... I mean, you're actually saying something that's actually scientifically accurate about MDMA, is that MDMA will actually deplete the amount of serotonin that you have in your brain for several days or even weeks afterwards. So there's that little rebound effect. But with LSD, LSD is actually mimicking an existing molecule. And so because LSD is mimicking the serotonin molecule, your brain thinks that it has more serotonin. And so what we have to ask is, well, what is serotonin doing? And serotonin is a highly common neurotransmitter. It's one of the most common neurotransmitters in the human body.
You can get it at Trader Joe's.
You can get it at Trader Joe's.
It's that common.
I know you can get serotonin supplements. There's serotonin precursors that you can take to generate your serotonin. But the... interesting thing about serotonin is that it's so omnipresent in the human body. It's even in the digestive system and in the muscles and in the spine. And it's associated with awareness and memory and attention. So that's basically what we know about serotonin. And interestingly also that there's a really fascinating history of serotonin where actually LSD spurred the development of research into the serotonin system. We had LSD, and we were using it in science before we knew anything about the serotonin system. And so scientists asked themselves, well, what is it that LSD is acting on such that it's causing these effects? And the answer was serotonin. So LSD, in a real sense, helped lead to the discovery of this serotonin system.
See? Yeah, I just had to say that.
Yeah, it's an important scientific tool as well as therapeutic. I think even people who aren't even interested in psychotherapy or end-of-life issues, I guess everybody should be interested in end-of-life issues because we'll all get there eventually.
That's right. The one common denominator.
That's right, exactly. You know, this is a scientific tool as well. We can use it as a microscope, as Stan Grof said, or a telescope also, as Stan Grof said. We can use it as a tool for unlocking how the human mind is working. So even if you're not a hippie and you're not interested in psychotherapy or you're not interested in anything else, that in itself is a fantastic reason to support LSD research.
Well, it is very interesting. I actually, off subject, like I happen to know three people that are in Peru right now participating in ayahuasca, guided ayahuasca experiment, I don't know, experiences. And they, you know, they describe their experiences as, you know, they're using it therapeutically. At least they claim they are.
Yeah. Yeah. Ayahuasca is a very different drug. In fact, it's a tea or a brew. It's a combination of different drugs. There's
two plants. put them together and they make you throw up.
That's definitely the first part. ayahuasca has exploded into the public spotlight lately.
It's very trendy, I think. I've heard that.
Yeah, the words trend and fad.
Yeah, I don't have any experience with it personally, but I keep reading about it, and I know people are personally using it and hearing their stories, and it is fascinating. I can see, it's easy for me to imagine how it works. You know, it seems like a very interpersonal type of a mirroring drug.
People talk about the same kinds of expansive awareness and senses of unity that they often get with LSD, but there's different commonalities to the ayahuasca experience, certainly.
Right. And, one of the things when I first learned about MAPS, one of the things that I was so surprised to learn that there were actually these experiments or trials with psychedelics going on in the United States at teaching hospitals, at famous teaching hospitals.
Yeah, we've got Johns Hopkins.
Tell us about each of them. You know, not every single one, but tell us about some of them and what's going on. I'm particularly interested in the PTSD trials with incurable PTSD soldiers and service people.
We're doing independent research right now with the MDMA and PTSD research. We have several investigator sites, two in the U.S. in South Carolina and Boulder, plus Canada and Israel.
What's an investigator site?
That means that they're independent investigators, and the research is sponsored, that is paid for, and also designed by MAPS. So these are independent researchers who are independent therapists. And then MAPS helps them design the research and recruit subjects and so on.
So if you have a therapist or a counselor, and they have they're working with clients who have severe PTSD that hasn't been able to be really controlled or subdued, or I don't really know the language.
Right.
Using medication and traditional counseling. And so then what the therapists approach you and they say, you know, I have a client and I know you're doing this work. And is that how it works?
Well, if you're asking about how we work with the investigators to get the study started.
Yeah.
MAPS, we have our mission. We want to support this research, and we're focused right now on MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's because of the really strong evidence we've already gotten, and because post-traumatic stress disorder is such a major public health concern right now, that we've been devoting so many resources to that. So then we'll look for a suitable investigator in site. A suitable investigator in site for our MDMA-assisted psychotherapy research, which is similar to our LSD-assisted psychotherapy research, is that they need to be a private practice investigator. There needs to be somebody who's trained in therapy and also somebody who can receive a Drug Enforcement Administration license to store and administer the drug. So that means there also has to be a psychiatrist. In the case of our MDMA research, our site in Charleston, the psychiatrist and the therapist are the same person, or rather the same team. Michael and Annie Mithoffer are a psychiatrist and a psychiatric nurse, husband and wife team, that they do the therapy together.
Tell us about some of the successes with the MDMA and PTSD trials.
Well, we completed our first pilot study of MDMA-assisted psychotherapy for PTSD and published it in 2010. That study was in 19 subjects. Primarily, they were female survivors of sexual assault and abuse. And all of them had tried other treatments for PTSD, including medications and therapy, and on average had suffered from PTSD for an average of 19 years. So these are some of the hardest cases of PTSD who have tried other things. And we found that after two MDMA-assisted psychotherapy sessions and six or eight standard psychotherapy sessions, that we got an 83% reduction in, or rather 83% of the subjects no longer qualified for PTSD.
Oh, come on.
After the study, 83% of them. And that's compared to 25% of those who received placebo.
Okay, that's a phenomenal number.
It is. It is far
beyond. Did this get anyone's attention?
It's gotten a lot of attention. And, you know, you might think, and people have asked, you know, isn't this just a sort of a psychedelic afterglow? Didn't they just have a great time during the study and then they were feeling good for a while?
No, they don't have any serotonin left afterwards. They do not feel good afterwards.
Right. Yeah, and there is a little bit of a depression that is a standard side effect of MDMA use, and some of the subjects did experience that. But we found that this 83% of the subjects who didn't have PTSD 2 months after the treatment, they still didn't have PTSD on average almost 4 years later.
Almost four. That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah, it's far beyond anything that we've seen in clinical trials for Prozac or Paxil or any other approved
medication. Well, so people who have really been suffering, I mean, 19 years, that is like a 19-year nightmare.
That's pretty much exactly what it is.
Right. It's like, you know, so people with this kind of PTSD or their physicians or somebody, they must be advocating and saying, hey, let them try this. Let's expand this. So what's happening in that arena?
Well, it's a totally different model from the standard medication treatment for PTSD, or really standard medication treatment for most things these days. The standard model of medication these days is take a drug, and if it helps you get better, it means you need the drug, and you'll probably take it for the rest of your life.
And if it doesn't help you, there's another drug you can augment that with, so you are taking more. I mean, if people cannot see the marketing here. Yeah, it's creepy.
Yeah, so instead, what we're doing is we're administering this drug twice. These results are after just two MDMA-assisted psychotherapy sessions. So there's something going on here that is not directly related to the amount of drug in somebody's system. In fact, it looks like it might be the opposite. Something is happening for these subjects, and a lot of the subjects talk about it, and more and more of them are coming out after the study saying, hey, this really changed my life. I want to talk about it. Something is happening that's changing their perspective, that's enabling them to talk about issues that they've maybe never been able to talk about, and to be open and compassionate with themselves as they process those difficult memories in just a few psychotherapy sessions.
And it's unbelievable. So is there any, you know, progress, I don't know what to say, clinically or legally, governmentally, that is going to make this kind of treatment more available to PTSD sufferers?
That is exactly our goal. We're right in the middle of what's called phase two drug development trials. And any pharmaceutical manufacturer, any research organization that wants to make a drug or a treatment legally available by prescription for people has to go through the Food and Drug Administration. So that's what we're doing. We're conducting trials that have been approved by the FDA in order to develop larger trials that will ultimately present the evidence to the FDA whether or not MDMA should be approved as a prescription medicine. And we're trying to do that for LSD as well. It's just that our MDMA research has advanced so much in the last few years, and we've just completed this first pilot study.
Are you optimistic that eventually you've come so far already.
Yeah, I'm incredibly
optimistic. You must
be optimistic.
And
after this week, with the publication of this LSD results and the kind of attention and support that we've gotten from so many...
Yeah, every third post on Facebook is maps, maps, maps.
That's phenomenal to hear. I will definitely tell our social media guy.
Yeah.
I'm very happy to hear that. But, you know, the attention that we've gotten for this tells me that things are really shifting very quickly. We expect, as long as we continue getting the funding from private donors that we need, because government and major foundations still don't support our work because of the history of stigma, as long as we keep getting that funding and we keep getting these results, we're currently estimating that MDMA could be a legally available treatment for PTSD by 2021 or 2022. That's in about 8 or 9 years.
Mm-hmm. Tell us how MAPS is funded.
MAPS is funded entirely through private contributions. That's individual donors giving anywhere from $1 to $200,000 and everywhere in between. We have some major funders, and we have lots and lots of smaller funders. We've reached out to foundations. We've reached out to government agencies who still haven't funded our work. And so every single dollar of the $17 million that we've invested, that we've spent on psychedelic research and education since 1986, has come from private donors.
It's not that much if you say since 1986.
It's really not that much. And actually, most of that $17 million came after 1994 or so. Because most of the work before then was my boss, MAPS founder Rick Doblin, sending emails and recruiting support to whoever he could. And then since then, it's been a continuous process of opening up and gaining more public support, bringing us to where we are now.
And do you find that do you find that physicians and scientists and medical professionals they're maybe secretly supportive of your work, but outwardly they can't really endorse it because of the stigmas?
Yeah, I think that's exactly where the challenge is that 99% of the time when I speak with physicians, psychiatrists, any sort of mental health practitioner, scientists, say, do you support work on this drug? Scientists say, well, yeah, it's a fascinating thing. It's just, my advisor is, he's weird about it. Physicians, especially those who treat post-traumatic stress disorder and people in the hospice field who deal with end-of-life anxiety, they say, yeah, well, if it works, can I use it now? Why can't I prescribe it?
Right.
It seems to be very effective, so can I use it? And I have to say, well, no, we have to get legal approval first, otherwise you're just breaking the law.
Right, but they can be an advocate.
But they can certainly be an advocate.
How can they be an advocate? How can they help advocate?
Well, they just need to educate people. They need to educate themselves and just learn about what's happening, because that's where the barrier is the long history that we've had of a lack of education about these drugs. And the more that people know about them, the more they'll be able to advise their patients, the more they'll be able to help reduce the harms of people using them in irresponsible ways. And once this research is approved and psychedelics are legally available for use in clinical settings, then they'll be the first to know. They'll be the first ones to be familiar with the approach, familiar with the treatment. They can be the first to get licensed and already have connections in this really fast-growing field. So there's a lot of opportunities professionally and in terms of treatment, and now's a really great time for people to educate themselves.
All the time is a really great time for people to educate themselves. But, the one thing that we haven't talked about is the most hazardous, the most feared drug of them all, marijuana.
Oh, yeah, that's a scary one.
That's a scary one. Now, I'm aware of some of the challenges that MAPS has faced in being able to conduct or being unable to conduct trials with marijuana. And here at the same time now, we're seeing kind of like this breaking down in Colorado and in Washington. And hey, Oregon, what's up?
Yeah.
Legalizing marijuana for recreational use, for any use.
Yeah.
I hate to say legalizing it strictly for recreational use, but legalizing it. And so that, any adult that wants to use it can. And so what effect does that have on, because you still haven't been able to gain government support for trials, right, with marijuana?
Right, right.
Right, so you have government-approved trials with MDMA, and you have government-approved trials with LSD, but the government just can't seem to say, go ahead and conduct trials with marijuana.
That's exactly right.
I was hoping you would say no, not quite.
it's bizarre and ironic, and I think it reveals what is going on with the war on drugs and how it relates to research. We have Barack Obama admitting that marijuana has medical benefits. Obviously, everybody else in the world already knew that. Barack, thank you.
He's not a real doctor.
He's not a real doctor. we have 20 states in the District of Columbia now that have enabled some form of medical use. We've got two states, Washington and
Colorado.
Yep. Thank you. That have legalized adult recreational use.
Yes.
every single day I have multiple stories about people using marijuana to treat post-traumatic stress disorder appear. Physicians' organizations are getting together and talking about how they can best recommend cannabis to their patients. And so we have this hugely exploding field of medical marijuana and recreational marijuana use. And the federal government still will not allow research into marijuana as a potential prescription medicine to begin.
Well, I know that we could get into a probably huge conversation about why that is and the money and in redirecting it from guns and coups to research and science, but we're not going to go there. I made my editorial. I'm happy. I'm satisfied. That was good enough.
Perfect. Perfect. Yeah, you know, today is March 7th. We've been waiting almost 4.5 months now for the Public Health Service to get back to us about our most recent protocol submission for that study. And that's almost the record for how long we've ever waited from a government agency for a response. We waited for 5 months once from the Public Health Service for them to say no.
Do you think that what might happen ultimately is that marijuana will be, in a sense, legalized, then you'll be able to conduct whatever trials you want?
Well, you know, it can be legalized at the state level.
Right.
And, you know, we can conduct research there and we can gather data. But first of all, any researchers conducting research with marijuana in Colorado can still have their doors knocked down by federal investigators.
Right, still federally, right.
Yeah, hasn't been. So why set up a lab and do the research and get all this approval if you can still be shut down?
Right.
And then the other issue with that is that in order to have a drug federally approved, you have to use a federally approved source of the drug to do the research.
Right, but the federally produced marijuana is so inferior in quality to the private market.
Yeah, researchers have pointed that out. We've in the last couple of years, we've communicated with the farm there.
Wait a minute. Our listeners, now some of our listeners know this, but I'm going to guess that most of our listeners are not aware that, listeners, sit down. Yes, the U.S. government has marijuana growing farms and has for what, 30, 40 years?
A long time. I'm not
right.
sure how long.
And they create joints and they distribute them to a small group of people who got in on early clinical studies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's two or three of those left. There may be a few more.
That's right. One of them, I think, either lives in Oregon or in Northern California. So I've met that individual. But I know that a lot of our listeners had no idea that, yes, the government all this time has been growing marijuana. Really poor quality. You don't want it. You don't want to be jealous of it.
it's definitely true that you can find a wider variety and probably higher quality at dispensaries in states that have approved medical use.
Right.
But yeah, you're right. The federal government, National Institute on Drug Abuse, they run a farm at the University of Mississippi, and it's the only source for marijuana for medical research in the United States. It's the only place that researchers can get marijuana if they want to do research. If you want to smoke a joint, you can go down to your corner and buy a joint. But if you want to do research, you have to go through the National Institute on Drug Abuse, which, as you might imagine, isn't too fond of studies intending to develop marijuana.
You haven't been to Portland. The streets are lined with marijuana plants.
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
I'm just kidding. No, I'm not. I have a picture.
Yeah. So that's what we're fighting against. We're trying to open up that blockade. We're trying to end that monopoly.
Well, that's such a conundrum, you know, considering the other research and the stigmas, and not everything has to make sense.
It makes sense if you see marijuana as the linchpin of the war on drugs, and if you see it as something where there's a lot of economic and political investment.
That's
already
right.
Being placed.
Right, right. Yeah. Line items. It's all about line items.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. I think it just makes sense in a way that a lot of people are still afraid to admit.
Right. So what's next for MAPS? You have a conference coming up in April, is that right?
We do not have a conference coming up this April. April, we had Psychedelic Science 2013. That was a huge success with 1,900 people from all over the world. Generated a lot of interest for our research and got the field really, really going. But this year, we're focusing on our research. We are supporting other smaller events in local areas and hoping to come back to the U.S. for a full international conference in 2017. In the meantime, do stay tuned for some European psychedelic research conferences.
Brad Burge, thank you so much for your time today on The Digital Divide.
It's been great, Rabia.
And listeners, you can go to maps.org, is that right?
Maps.org, M-A-P-S.org.
And there they can sign up for your newsletter and stay up to date on these stories and more.
That's right. We're also extremely active on Facebook and Twitter.
Thank you so much for your time, Brad.
Thank you so much, Rabia.
Bye. And we've been listening to Brad Burge, Communication Director at MAPS. This is your host, Rabia Yeaman. I wanted to give you an update. The interview, which was recorded on March 7th, then on March 17th, the Associated Press reported that the federal government signed off on a long-delayed study looking at marijuana as a treatment for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, a development that drug researchers are hailing as a major shift in U.S. policy. So we look forward to seeing more progress on that front. Stay tuned. Moving On is coming right up on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
KBOO.FM for the latest haps here at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, Hood River and the Gorge at 91.9 FM, Philomath and Corvallis at 104.3 FM, and streaming on the web at KBOO.FM.
I hate a song that makes you think that you're not any good. I hate a song that makes you think you're just born to lose, bound to lose, no good to nobody, no good for nothing, because you're either too old or too young or too fat or too thin or too ugly or too this or too that. Songs that run you down are songs that poke fun at you on account of your bad luck or your hard traveling. I am out to fight those kind of songs to my very last breath of air and my last drop of blood. I'm out to sing songs that will prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that will make you take pride in yourself. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Don Jacobson, and the program is Moving On. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Wonder Ballroom, presenting the infamous String Dusters April 18th and Fruition April 19th. Tickets and information for the infamous String Dusters and Fruition April 18th and 19th at the wonderballroom.com. And the Aladdin Theater presenting an evening with Arlo Guthrie Wednesday, April 16th at 8 p.m. Tickets and information for the Arlo Guthrie April 16th at Aladdin is available at Aladdin-theater.com. Few minutes, we're going to have some live music with the Quiet Americans. In the meantime, we're going to play some things from a local group called the Trail Band. I'm not sure if they're still performing. If anybody knows, you can call me right here at 231-8187. From a CD called Oregon Stories, we're going to hear Daddy's Dream.
We were raised in a timber town where the rains can pull you down. Well, you can choose to dream or drown, our daddy'd say. There the mill paid decent wage, but there was nothing much left to save. And that's why Daddy had a dream he'd drive us far away someday. Daddy's dream was a farm block, sitting in the rain with a crack gearbox. That old one-eyed Ford with a running board was better than a score bar swing. Sister Jean would drive 4 miles while I played with the radio dial. Start come that spring, but the years died one May, and they hauled his dream away. And it broke my heart to think he'd never fix that old machine. But our mama said he knew that we could never, ever move. He just kept that car around to teach his baby.